Hello, and welcome to Benyo Chats. If you're curious about the world, this show is for you. How should we think about venture philanthropy and impact investing? On this episode, I speak to Nina Ginet. Nina is CEO of Jasmine Social Ventures. They find and fund high-performing social ventures and entrepreneurs. We discuss her process and philosophy, what she looks for, and the successes and challenges. Hope you enjoy the show. Do like and subscribe or leave a review as it helps others find the podcast. And with that, here's my chat with Nina. Hey, everyone. I'm super excited to be speaking to Nina Ginet. Nina is CEO of Jasmine Social Investments, a private foundation in New Zealand that funds high-performance social ventures, solving big problems in the poorest geographies. Nina, welcome.
Thank you, Ben. I'm excited to see where this conversation goes. And I'm also having the opportunity to share what we've been up to lately. But let me first echo Jerome's sentiment in your last podcast about the incredible list of guests that you have assembled and how humble I am to be among them.
Oh, thank you very much. But no, the work you do is all super great. And I think this kind of venture investing or philanthropy investing is super interesting. So I kind of roll up the first two questions together, which would be, tell us about Jasmine and what does venture philanthropy mean to you?
Sure, of course. So Jasmine is a private foundation based in New Zealand, and we have been doing this type of work for more than 15 years. The foundation's goal is to fund scalable impact. And what this means is we look for organizations that provide basic needs services to families living in poverty. An example would be a community health program that brings primary care to a rural village in Liberia, where in the past, patients had to endure a walk of 10 hours to the nearest clinic. And today you have a health worker in the village that is diagnosing and treating children at the doorstep of their homes. So we have decided to execute on this vision by building a portfolio, as you've mentioned, high-performing social ventures that are fundable by us and others. So we search the earth for the best operators we can find. We add these individuals when they're designing high impact interventions and they're early in the journey. And once the model has been iterated several times and tested and bulletproof, we expect them to scale them to those in need, to thousands, if not millions of people. So Jasmine is currently supporting 25 of them working in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. We've learned through the years that the kind of impact that we want to see, for example, a child reaching the fifth anniversary, usually requires what we call a permanent donor subsidy. So that means that philanthropy needs to step in. And this is why the bulk of our effort is providing grants to nonprofits. Nonetheless, 20% of them are for-profit structures, which kind of gets me to your second question, right, about what does venture philanthropy mean to Jasmine? So we work for a philanthropist. His name is Sam Morgan, who has been on both sides of the table. First, as an entrepreneur, founding what became New Zealand's largest online auction. And today, he's an investor and advisor to several tech startups. So the one commonality that most foundations have, other than the corporate ones, is that we get to work with individuals who are very successful in their own right. And the question really becomes, how can we use our best asset, our principles, to design a philanthropic arm that obviously represents what they want to do, but also takes advantage of who they are and keeps them engaged along the way? And in our case, the answer was drawing from best practices in the two fields that Sam is an expert on: entrepreneurship and venture capital. So I would say that on the entrepreneurial side, we back people. We're not looking for projects or have a priority geography list, etc. And the Skoll Foundation was a source of inspiration in the early days when they created a forum in Oxford to celebrate social entrepreneurs. And back in 2004, the idea of social entrepreneurship was new. So our interpretation of that is to favor entrepreneurs going to social entrepreneurship rather than social workers wanting to become one. And then last, on the investing side, we apply the same framework we would to identify and fund software companies. So are they managing by numbers? Is there financial discipline, self-governance, hiring and retaining talent? And then we perform like really high quality due diligence. And then we support our investees the best way we can. And sometimes when you back talent, that means give them money and leave them alone.
That sounds excellent. And perhaps picking up on that, so one of the concepts in early stage, particularly venture, is that the venture company often gives help or supports investees to some extent. Sometimes, like you say, it's just money and you leave them alone, but often it's giving them kind of other type of help, access to networks, ideas, business models, and that type of thing. So I guess in the form of venture philanthropy, do you still give help and support investee companies in the same way? And how is giving help to support investees done for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And because we do work with people really early in the journey, it's a lot of fun to grow with them. And then, you know, so I started my career in investment banks, reading a lot of stock reports, as I'm sure you do once in a while in your day job. So I was really intrigued about the idea of translating this very published report that is shared among investors and gives you a really good overview of the management and the strategy going forward, but also really an important snapshot of the relevant metrics and the financials that you need to pay attention. And this is one of the work that we do with our grantees. We have this thing called the Jasmine Scorecard, where we help them understand metrics and how to slice and dice some of their financials and how you look, how can you translate it over time. So the good news is in the social sector, information has always been available to everyone through the website. You can find you know, the quarterlies and the tax returns and the audited financials and anything you want. So our role at Jasmine was twofold. One, to get grantees DD ready. And this means showing nonprofits what a professional data room should look like. And the other one was writing a comprehensive analysis that has three different purposes. The first and foremost is drive our internal decisions, and we make them on an annual basis, which means that we put our investees through this process every year. The second is we would share this information with them. They get to see when it's 95% there and they can fact check or argue some points that we've made. And this helps investees and their boards to look at the work in through a different lens, and everyone finds it incredibly refreshing. But the third one is the most important, I think, because it elevates a conversation with other donors. I mean, we do this kind of work for Sam, and it'd be silly if we wouldn't share it for other ones to use and abuse as they want. So what we hear again and again is that someone would have a 60-minute pitch with a potential funder. And normally, you know, this conversation starts with, oh, can you tell me what you do? But on the other hand, many of them start with, oh, we just read the Jasmine report. Can we get on some questions that we have? And that's fantastic, because at the end of the day, these organizations only have 6 to 10 minutes. So this last piece around sharing, which is exactly what the banks do with their research and have done for decades, was actually an innovation of its own when we started 15 years ago. So it's been exciting. I mean, we put our work out there and we shared with lots of people and encourage others. And it's great to see a lot of funders today and sharing, being comfortable with sharing their internal documents. And as I always think about it, we are in the business of advancing human dignity. And that means, just why would you not share your diligence? But we should. So we disseminate our analysis twice a year. There's someone in our family office that keeps this list and writes everyone like personalized emails. And we have a distribution list of more than 100 funders. They're all types of, you know, sizes and shapes. And some of the ones that come back with the curiosity and arguments about things that they didn't agree are some of the smaller foundations that really know their grantees really well. So the list includes family foundations like us, new philanthropies, and if you saw your business recently, probably an investment banker would have done one on you. So it's very relatable when you're kind of going from this commercial to this social, and then you come across like a report that you can totally relate to it. And they help analysts in places like USAID. So it's been exciting to see the Jasmine reports being passed around. People ask, oh, is it okay if I pass it? I'm like, yeah, you should just move it on. And then also they're seen as a common good. And to be honest, if I look back at when I started this job, what Sam wanted to do with this foundation, we never thought this was going to happen. So it's been a nice surprise.
Yeah, it's excellent. So I've read a few reports, and they are very much like what we call in our side of the world, a kind of sell side investment report. And bringing that kind of discipline to thinking about the charitable sector, I think, is really refreshing. And like you say, it's really helpful for all of the stakeholders involved. I guess as a follow-on on that, how do you identify opportunities when you're thinking about what to write about or what to investigate? And when you identify opportunities, are there any particular criteria you use or how you think about themes? We've already touched on a couple about this kind of ability to scale. You're also very interested essentially in kind of deep poverty and things like that. But I'd be interested in a little bit more detail on the kind of opportunity piece and thinking about criteria or themes.
Yeah. And well, first, thank you for reading them. And I hope they stacked up to your many reports that you read. So through this kind of sharing and caring is we have joined the global conversation from New Zealand, which is an enormous task, given that we normally sleep when everyone else is awake. So through these years, we've built an ecosystem of funders, and they're our main source of ideas. So I just want to make sure you know and understand that we're not just a team in the middle of the South Pacific with a spreadsheet saying yes and no. We don't do that. I mean, we do sometimes do that, but, you know, we also, you know, get a chance to travel in country. We did incredible trip in West Africa, Liberia, and Senegal this last spring. And this is a way to stay connected to the people we serve, find new ideas. But we're also close to a lot of the people that are working with the next generation of social entrepreneurs through fellowships and creators and consultants. Now, most recently, we have been really thinking internally at finding ways to find those extraordinary individuals in pockets of the world that our traditional networks need to reach. We have a handful of STEM for MBAs in our portfolio and we really love them. So if you're listening and you are one, please continue to apply. But if that's your target, your pool's really limited. So how can we adjust the way we assess opportunities or we look at new ideas to attract different type of candidates? And remember that time is our biggest enemy. I mean, we throw through 300, 400 ideas, not all of them with the same intensity, and we're a small team. So we had to expand the reach of the funnel with men doubling down on the team and having multiple conversations. And I'm really proud to say that the last five or six additions are enterprises led by Nigerians, Malawians, and Indians. And this wasn't the case a few years ago. So that's something that the team is really proud of. And then I guess last on identifying is there's the best leads happen in the most random conversations. Like the one that you and I had, you've just given me a couple of good ones. So when you're looking for, you're always on the look for great people, you just need to allow that kind of serendipity. And now, back to your question on criteria and themes. Well, on the criteria side, we have used the same criteria for the last 15 years, which is kind of a rare phenomenon of its own. So we talked about the basic needs, which encompasses primary healthcare and education. We do a bit of early childhood development, livelihoods, climate resilience, the entrepreneurial spirit also that we discussed, and then and making bets with early stage organizations that have some evidence of impact. But, you know, we like scalable models, which means that, you know, that implies that they have a cost structure that keeps going down and eventually the governments can absorb because, you know, when you're in the basic needs area, you need to scale to the public sector. We also stick to this 80-20 rule where the majority of your work falls under that criteria. It's just these five criteria that I've mentioned. And as a small productive team, we really need to be on focus, but the 20% allows you to experiment with models that may challenge that core criteria. But in our case, what we found is while the exceptions have been fantastic and really enjoyable, they've also solidified the fact that our original criteria was fine. So the last dimension that we look for is the right fit. And it's really integral to the selection process because we have a very diligence-heavy process. And it really needs to be productive on both ends. So the fit becomes very evident in the first conversation that we have with people. And unfortunately, being based in New Zealand, Zoom has been for many years our, you know, way to talk to people. And you talk to someone and you can be able to articulate a clear vision and think numerically, and then you're like, fantastic. Or in terms of things, and this is an interesting conversation because I think giving sometimes can be incredibly seasonal. And I don't understand why, but I see money chasing specific trends and then they change the strategy and they get onto a different path. And it's a non-intentional behavior of funders, but it's kind of a harmful practice for those operators that are in the trend or outside of the trend suddenly. Also, the problems that we're trying to solve are here to stay. So when you think about the importance of the first 1,000 days of a child's development, that was important 50 years ago, but will continue to be 100 years from now. And Jasmine was established at the end of 2006, inspired by the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. In 2015, those became, you know, a set of very ambitious 17 social development goals. So the SDGs, as they're called, really provide this excellent framework. So when you kind of look at the SDG and our criteria, we come up with a good set of investment principles.
That makes a lot of sense. And so a couple of things I get from that is when you're thinking about opportunities for investments in the future, quite a lot of them are the same opportunities that we've had in the past 15 years because these primary needs of humans, education, healthcare, what is now wrapped up in the SDGs remain the same. I think that's quite interesting. The other thing on the criteria that you're using, that you're thinking about, so scale, impact, and we can maybe talk about some of the measurement things. But you touched on this, and we've been discussing on and off the kind of role of the kind of founder, the social entrepreneur. So I guess this is a question which doesn't have any answers because if we really had this, it would be really easy. But I was wondering, what are the qualities that perhaps you're looking within a social entrepreneur that really kind of stand out? And I'll mention a couple that you've already spoken about. So the ability to articulate a vision, ideally simply analytical skills. So if you have a vision but you can't talk about it in terms of some whatever you're talking about is obviously important, and perhaps a tilt to people who understand that and want to move, you know, they're essentially entrepreneurs and they want to do something socially. But is there anything else that you would point to, and do you perhaps have a favorite question or two or quality or two which makes you enable to kind of unpick this, particularly over a kind of Zoom type thing, about this is the kind of qualities in a social entrepreneur CEO that you're looking for?
Yes, and obviously, I mean, we work with people that are serial entrepreneurs, and that obviously they've done it. They're, you know, one of them sold the first company in 25, and another one built a $100 million company, and that decided to do this. So obviously, that's It's easier because they've done it before. But we also work with entrepreneurs in the making. And it's kind of that curiosity and big ambition and this internal interest in getting to the solution. And sometimes a very simplified way to understand what needs to happen in the next 12 months. Like the next 12 months, I am gonna de-risk my model, which means I'm gonna do A, B, and C. And A may happen and B won't, so we'll be able to pivot really quickly. But they're able to focus and de-risk their model in a very systematic kind of way.
Yeah,
I'm not an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So I can see, I mean, there's a bit of pattern recognition because I've worked with both of them, but I'm always fascinated when they explain the reasoning and how simple it looks, because I just wouldn't be able to do that.
I agree. And often they'll say, you know, by July, I think I'll have done A, B, C. And then you check in and yes, I did A, I did B, but I didn't do C either because of reason X or because I thought reason Z. And now I'm going to do D, E, and F. So there's this focus and operational side, as well as the fact that it is adhering to some kind of vision as well.
I think, but Ben, also, it's obviously very hard to build a big business in the Bay Area. But the people that we work with, I mean, they work in very unstable conditions, right? Difficult governments and transitions, and you know, already it's so complex and has so many different layers, and it's so I think you have to be a very good and very methodical entrepreneur and have all these business principles of that kind of what we talked about, right? The numbers and the financials and be moving along. But at the same time, with social entrepreneurs, you need to know and be comfortable with chaos.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. And you have to, I guess, a lot more flexibility in how you work using the local environment.
Yeah, you need to, I mean, you're going to be navigating through a lot of ups and downs and you need to adjust to it. So should we, right, as founders, really understand that there is an up and down and have a more of a long-term view?
Great. And I think a lot of people would probably say this is a form of impact investing, but it's kind of quite broadly defined. And I'm not sure you yourselves view this. Obviously, that you are making impact, but you kind of use this idea of venture more. I mean, I wonder whether you do view yourself as impact investing and maybe what's most misunderstood about that or not. And I guess one of the elements of investing in this way with impact is this idea that you kind of measure and track what you're doing. You might have some other, in profit organizations, it's easier because you're kind of tracking profit at the end and other metrics which go into that. In nonprofit, yeah, it can be harder. Some of your KPIs actually can be quite clear. Death in childbirth and things like that are quite clear metrics, but others are not. So I'm kind of interested in about like how your understanding of impact investing is and where you might fit in. And also what to what extent can you measure and track these items and how important is it for you?
Yeah, and it's an interesting conversation because we definitely fit in the impact investing category, not always, because we're grant makers as well. And I don't think we would consider ourselves as impact investor. Actually, probably we wouldn't. So the main difference for those in the audience less familiar with the term is that you can deploy money first as a grant, some money out the door, or second, as an impact investment, which means debt or equity. So you would give someone a loan, they need to repay, or you would become an investor in a company. Now, the first misunderstanding about impact investing is the second word, and it's the impact, is that investors quickly fall into that argument of, well, I'm going to lower my return expectation for a bit of impact. And impact is not always fractional, right? Like, ideally, you don't want students to be partially numerate or literate. You want them to finish primary school being functionally literate and numerate at the bare minimum. Another misunderstanding is that quantifying impact is just too hard. But, you know, when you're a commercial, if you were an investor in Uber, you wouldn't be saying like, oh, let's just, maybe they should be a bit less profitable because convenient rides are such a social need. Oh, hey, can we stop asking management about the financial accounts? And this shouldn't be in the impact investing. So in terms of our strategy, we are incredibly opportunistic on impact investing. So at Jasmine, we make impact investments only when there is a commercial model that has the potential to create real impact. And we don't compromise on that, which means that there's a profitable enterprise behind. And an interesting way to look at it is you look at the cost that is required to achieve that tangible result. For example, you're helping a farmer increase their yields so they can feed their family year-round. And sometimes you can cover the cost of serving that client with the revenues you collect, but other times you just need that philanthropic cushion. And that's what we call the subsidy. So when we're talking to organizations, and because we do talk to a lot of people that are really early in the days, is we have that kind of subsidy discussion on one big thing. Is it a permanent donor subsidy, or do you think you have a profitable model? So, but we have always been about group first and vehicle after, and that allows us to look for the talent and then decide what is the most appropriate type of capital that they need. And we're very fortunate that the legal framework in New Zealand provides us with the flexibility to operate this way. We're less limited than our friends in Australia or the US. So in total, I'd say that we have deployed 80% of the funds have been grants and 20% in impact investing. And most recently, we're doing a lot of work on the debt space because there's very few of us that can do low-cost debt. And some of this, both nonprofits and for-profit, have this working capital requirements. So it's been a bit of fun to play a little bit of a catalytical role in that space.
And actually, that might be increasingly important if the environment of higher interest rates remains. So essentially, what we'd say in the business, the cost of capital, essentially the cost of debt is rising. So ability to access cheaper debt on whatever terms might be quite interesting. And it does strike me that one of the advantages of your model is to be able to be structure neutral. If grant making seems to be the way forward, and however you need to structure that grant, then you can do it. If it's some other type of way of doing it, then that will be there too. But it also strikes me, even within your grant making, you're tracking some forms of measurement. It's just not, we can give some money away, we're checking with you a year, and let's hope that everyone's happy. You've got that rigor which has come through. And I think that's been a sort of, I guess, you know, in the last couple of decades, philanthropy has got more on board with that, but it still seems to be a relatively young idea that actually, even if you are going to give away grants, there is some way, or there should be some onus on the people involved to measure and track how effective that is, because you're going to have a cost and all of those types of things. So that strikes me as, do you think the bottleneck for your sort of either investing or grant making is on the funding side? Or do you see that there's other hurdles, sort of ideas or regulatory or just the coordination problem or things set up? Where do you see the bottleneck or the challenges, I guess, in philanthropy or in venture philanthropy at the moment?
Yeah, and we should get back on that on the measurement, because I think that's it's an important part of who we are and what we do is that we do believe that you need to be able to quantify impact. So in terms of funding of bottlenecks, there is always room for improvement on the funder side, I must say, because I'm part of that group. And I joined Heather Grady and her team at the Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors on an initiative that I think is very important called the Shifting Systems. And that's about encouraging funders to become long-term and restricted funders like us, but also be very more savvy around the diligence they do and how they collaborate with others. And we're not perfect donors. We're constantly reflecting on you know, how we can do better. Did we use all the documents we requested? Are we asking for the right questions in the right way? And how we add, as we've discussed, more value outside of the dollars we provide, which the answer is always the same. Do short, to the point diligence and connect us to more money. But on the supply side, we have been given a lot of thought about how can Jasmine play a role in helping other social ventures bring that strategic thinking early on the pieces we have been doing with our grantees. And is there a toolkit maybe that we can, you know, we can put on our website that provides groups outside of our portfolio, because we're only going to be able to work with 30, 40 or 50, let's say, but how can we have the next 500? And obviously it involves the theory of change and designing for impact and mapping behaviors changes, but increasingly it incorporates that idea about the financials and how important they are. And forecasting 3 or 5 years ahead, which is a very unnatural process for nonprofits. And it's not because they don't think it's important, it's because they need to raise money every single year. So if you forecast 5 years ahead, you need to explain every single year that you need money is whether you met those expectations. It just doesn't count. And I understand, it's conflicting interests, but anyway, understanding the economics of your business and what's today, it's important. So I think, I don't know, I mean, I think there's this bottlenecks both on the doer and donor side, as we call it. And we have been trying to think more broadly on how can we help.
That makes a lot of sense and it's pretty interesting. And I guess I was going to pick up maybe on the measurement piece again, if you wanted to make some comments.
Yeah.
Maybe interlink this with, I do think one of the slightly unusual aspects of what you guys do is this emphasis on the ability to scale, or at least it being an element, which is actually very typical in venture capital in general. Actually less usual as companies grow really big. So in big public equities, you might be interested in growth, but they're already so big, they are at scale, essentially. They may be scaling other things. So I'd be interested to know, how important is it when you look at things about an organization's ability to scale? And is there something that you can kind of measure, or is that measurement part of it? And I guess particularly when you're looking at entrepreneurs in the making or businesses which are essentially at, call it that seed or that quite early stage, the ability to know whether they're going to scale or not is often quite uncertain, I guess. So I'd be interested in how you're thinking about an organization's ability to scale, how important it is, and what you're looking for in terms of that.
And I'd say that scale is the most important criteria that we have, because, we want to make bets on people that will end up figuring it out. And I have a service that will save lives. And when this happens, we obviously want this to go to millions and millions of people. And so that's kind of the hope and dream of it. We define this is an the way we define scale, we define it as an intervention that can reach up to 1 million people. It doesn't necessarily need to be multi-country. We work with an organization called Luala that are influencing the way that health is provided to 1 million people in one district in Kenya, and that's very important. And we support those groups during the R&D phase. But what we do expect them is to scale their work only when they have that strong evidence on hand, but also the right economics and that impact. And we support them through that journey and fund them as long as they show us success every year. And that's why having a set of metrics and scorecards and milestones, we're not sticklers for, you said you were going to do 10 and you've only done 9. You're out the door, right? We understand that there's ups and downs and we're very long-term funders. But I think that it's a good structure for those organizations to have and then a good discussion for the funders. So I mean, one example I could give you, if I'm allowed to brag a little bit, is the first grantee that we added was in 2008. His name's Andrew Yoon. He's the founder of One Acre Fund. And he's getting the Health of Humanitarian Award next week, which I'm very proud of. And Andrew had this pilot with $500,000 budget and 600 farmers, was working with subsistence farmers. And today, One Acre Fund is a $300 million nonprofit with more than $200 million in revenue that works with 2 million farmers directly. But they also work with another 2 million through government channels. So, wow.
How long did that take to scale?
10, 20 years?
15 years, yeah. So it's not, you know, that's quick, right? I mean, that's not too slow, right? And that you can still do it. For organizations thinking about applying to you, what would you suggest they think about? We've touched on how scale is quite important, vision, also execution, and showing those type of things. But is there anything else you think more broadly they should be thinking about in terms of interesting to you?
Yeah. So first, I expect them to demonstrate a deep understanding of the problem they're solving, as you are always a student of your own sector. And that obsession around the problem you're solving and the people that you serve really needs to come across in the first 10 minutes of the conversation. I also like candidates who can articulate a clear vision and translate that theory of change into how the model really works in practicality, or what they think the pathway to scale can be. But at the same time, you need to know your numbers, because, you know, without the numbers, it's just an idea. And you know, we really like people to do their work before they come and talk to us. So having some numbers on your fingertips, like the budgets and the beneficiaries and the impact indicators, but also have a good grasp on the makeup of your financials is really important. And we don't expect them to have the right answers, and we do work with early stage ventures, so, but at least to demonstrate that they have done that homework, and those are the things that they're just worried, concerned, keeps them up at night.
Right. So that leads me on to saying, tell me about some of your investees and some of the successes. We mentioned one pretty brilliant one, but I don't know if there's others you want to highlight. And perhaps you might also want to highlight what you might have learned from one or two failures or mistakes which haven't worked out, and maybe why. So tell me about your investees, any successes, any mistakes if you would like, although we can concentrate on both.
Yeah, fantastic. So New Globe is one of the most fascinating bets we've made. And the idea behind is that if you are the best teacher with the best connectivity, you just wouldn't have the time to read all the research on education and best practices and then translate it into a lesson plan. It'd be impossible for you to do. So this is what New Globe does. They do the heavy lifting, and they train and coach teachers and provide them with these lesson guides packed with evidence-based research. So today they employ about 150 people in Massachusetts doing instructional design. That's all they do. And these are based on a billion data points that they collect throughout the year. The interesting part about New Globe and how we met them is that we made an equity investment in the company in 2008 to build a network of private academies in Nairobi. And then a few years later, they called us because they needed a grant to bring this model to Liberia. And back then, Liberia had an incredible visionary president, Madame Shirley, who was the first elected female head of state. And this experiment would allow New Globe to transport their model where they didn't control all the variables, but where the need was, you know, was massive, right? But and that shifted the model. And now they're partnering with innovative government that want to reform public systems. They have 2 million kids under contract. You know, Professor Kramer, who won the Nobel Prize in 2019, released this RCT saying that they have the largest learning gains ever in education. So it's been exciting to see.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I will get onto another example. I just wanted to comment on that area with the scale. Essentially, some people kind of call it a kind of meta science area, because like you say, what you're doing is you're giving the teachers the tools and empowering all of that level. And it seems to me that this, I don't quite know how you get to it, but there seems to be a lot of unknowns in terms of the best ways of how we should do things. You know, what are the best ways of teaching? What are the best ways of doing science funding? What are the best ways of combating that? And when you can get a group or an organization which can make discoveries and do that, then you have enormous scale impact, particularly at the kind of second order. So that seems really exciting. So yeah, another example, if you wanted.
Oh, yeah.
We could talk about that one as well. Yeah.
No, I mean, look, I mean, we could have three more podcasts about education, because it's a fascinating subject. As you and I are educators in our coursework of our kids. And then education is also a very controversial. It's more controversial, I think, than in health, where you really know that if you do A, B, and C. So I think that structural pedagogy, it's been important, and Professor Kramer's RCT is a great way to show that these things really work. So, all right, so I'm going to go on a second example. There's a group called, and this one is at the intersection between health and education. So Healthy Learners is an organization in Zambia that turns teachers into health workers, and schools where the kids spend most of the time as triage grounds to reduce morbidity to that 5 to 15 year old group. And there's a lot of emphasis, rightly so, on the under fives in these countries. But what happens with the older kids is, parents are having a harder time justifying getting a day out of work to stay, for hours at a clinic waiting. And then what is a scratch may develop into a permanent disability if not caught on time. So school health is not an innovation of its own, but normally it's like a one person with one rule. And what Healthy Learners is trying to do in Zambia, and they have a massive buy-in from both the ministers of education and health, is that by doing that, what happens is that attendance goes up, because parents, they have a kid with a cough and they send them to school because they know the school is going to look after them. They link to the clinics, and the clinics are very excited because they get to see these cases really early on the piece. And then once students are triaged, they go up the list, and then the waiting time goes to like 30 minutes. So that's an exciting one.
That's really interesting as well, because that reflects that even in rich nations, like here in the UK, there's a lens of, for instance, pupils in need have these free school meals, because they found that if people are not eating enough, right, you've got undernutrition, then you get all of these other poor outcomes. So even in rich nations, you have these kind of, people are kind of discovering these intersectionalities. And actually, I think that's something that, the UK and others could learn, because we're probably not as good as doing some of those things for some of our own challenges, let alone the sort of challenges that you have in poorer nations. So yeah, you had another example.
Yeah. So I'm going to squeeze in another example, if you allow me. And this is an oldie but goodie. So Vision Spring, which we also added in 2009. And by the way, one thing that we're really proud of is that we've added a lot of these organizations that we continue to support 15 years later. And that's also rare. And it's important because, it does take many, many years to activate this change. So there's more than 2 billion people that really suffer from blurry vision, and this massively impacts the quality of life. So we've been funding Vision Spring that creates access to affordable eyewear so that people in low-income communities can see well, but also do well. And these are tailors and artisans or factory workers. And glasses is really a 13th century invention. And it's just this simple but yet powerful tool that allows workers to perform eyes training roles and students to see the blackboard and cab drivers to stay safe on the road. So Vision Spring wants to make clear vision a reality for everyone. 50% of the customers are first-time wearers. And they're also building this body of evidence to demonstrate that a simple pair of glasses can improve the productivity and incomes by 20 and 30%, which means that when you put together these 9 million pairs that they have delivered since the early 2000s, they really unlocked like $1.8 billion in economic earning potential.
That's another great example. And did you want to reflect on a mistake or a failure? There's this idea that actually, what is the aphorism that no mistake or failure is a failure if you learn from it? Because a lot of things in venture aren't going to work out, right? But if you've got learnings from it, then they're not necessarily as big a failure as you might have thought.
Yes, and to be honest, we have a lot of successes in our portfolio, and that's given us a jaded view of what success means, which in terms what's resulted is in us making less bets. So we're very conscious of changing that, and you can't, because you have some really good ideas, and that everyone, like, your idea of what success looks is the engineers and the vision springs and the new goals, right? But you still need to go, like, our job is to go out and make bets on new and proven models. One thing we learned very early in the process is you may fall in love with a very charismatic entrepreneur, but you really need to be very much in tune with what they do. And an example is, for example, is someone that had a model where they would go into a village and would do a lot of different things. I can do a little bit of health, a little bit of education, etc. And our general view was that it's very hard to do one thing on its your own. And we really wanted to find people that were obsessively trying to be a good educator. So 3 years later, what happened is that we kind of never really lived in this multi-sector approach to poverty. So it was really hard for this entrepreneur to convince us because we didn't buy into the first idea. So that's I think it's unfair, because they're trying to convince you for 3 years on something that you maybe didn't really believe in the first place.
Sure. And would there have been anything that could have convinced you? So I guess this is the idea that focus on one thing is essentially a superior model. But there is a small counterexample sometimes that doing two or three things together gets you a synergy. But it tends to be really difficult at startup. That tends to be a big company idea rather than at startup tends to be focused. And actually, you're now moving away from conglomerate models, even a big company, that actually, if they spin off their business units to focus on something, you get a more appropriate strategy and the like.
Yes, and we don't necessarily have very strong views, as a reminder. We're like writing checks from very far away, right? And we're definitely not the experts. But I think the preference was really on focusing and specializing in one thing, which is what everyone in the portfolio does want. And if that's what your preference is, then maybe you shouldn't be, you know, adding someone in the portfolio whose preference is to be very good at five things.
That makes sense.
And
okay.
I think it goes back to a little bit on the criteria and then deciding that you only have, you know, time to work with a handful of people, and then what are the right bets for you?
Yeah, certainly. If you say, "Oh, I'm gonna work on five SDGs," as opposed to "I'm just gonna work on one," and maybe the second one comes along, is particularly at early stage. I think clarity of vision definitely comes into that. Great. Well, maybe pivoting to a couple of more fun things or different things. What is, I guess, about being based in New Zealand? And so I'm interested to know what you think there are the advantages and disadvantages to being based in New Zealand. I guess you've already hinted one is that in some ways you're afar which gives you the ability to look perhaps more critically, but you also travel to Africa and places and be on the ground. You know, I wasn't aware there was a very large investing scene within New Zealand, so it does seem quite a far place. But I don't know if there's any advantages or disadvantages to you, do you think, about being based in New Zealand?
Yeah, so there's a few. I wouldn't say disadvantages, maybe inconveniences. So for example, it does take 35 hours to get to Nairobi, and you need to spend like 5 or 6 hours in a couple of random airports. And the other one is that we are the only, I mean, the investing scene, I think more in the tech space is thriving, and more so in the 20 years that I've been in New Zealand, but not so much the social sector. So we're the only funder doing this type of work in New Zealand, and we do get lonely. We do. So that's what I think. But there are so many advantages. You know, you work in this neutral territory, and you get less caught up on the trends and the who is who. And we're hyper focused because we get a lot done when the rest of the world is sleeping. And, you know, sharing the work and having these interactions with different funders and doing reference calls has really helped us get connected. But of course, visiting grantees and, you know, attending the Scope Forum, which is the one event that I never miss, is incredibly important to keep us motivated and then connected to our peers.
Right. And thinking wider, do you think there is anything more particularly unique or misunderstood about New Zealand? I guess from the outside world, you know, the cliches are around rugby and cricket. Here, at least in the UK, there are jokes about sheep. I think milk is actually still quite a big export, if I remember correctly, and it being far away, but also being amazingly beautiful. You know, I think, is it Lord of the Rings territory, and right, the countryside and everything and the cities. So be interested in your reflections about what's unique about New Zealand, or maybe misunderstood, because I'm sure it isn't all about sheep and cricket.
No, and maybe I did marry one of the few Kiwis that do not like rugby. But my view may be a bit skewed, and it is really it's beautiful. It's easy, and it's really great to have kids growing up in New Zealand, especially. One of the things that is really unique is that you get to be a generalist, you know, especially when you work in places like New York or London, where being a specialist is so important, and you try to change your job, and they're like, no, you do equities, you don't do that. In New Zealand, we get to do that, and this means you need to be very comfortable with being the person in the room that knows the least about the conversation, but you're also motivated with the learning journey. And that is also about, you know, when we think about our work at Jasmine, we are generalists, and we touch upon a lot of different things, and we don't know much, but it's just that if you are a learner, it's a fascinating country to be in. You need to do a lot of different things.
Great. Okay, and then we'll have a little fun section of overrated, underrated. Just a couple of things that you might think about that. I'm going to start with a fun one. So overrated, underrated, Spanish food, or you could be more in particular and go Catalan food, but Spanish food, do you think it's underrated or overrated?
Oh, always underrated.
So of course, you have a Catalan background.
Absolutely. And the beauty of the products and the proudness of, you know, everyone, you grow up, you know, cooking with your moms and your grandmas. And that idea when going to the market and going to every stall and talking to everyone. And then I think this, I mean, the fresh produce and the fish is it's fantastic. But there is a way around, you know, Catalan people eat, and especially in Barcelona where the weather is so fantastic and everyone is always outside, standing up, eating.
Yeah. And does New Zealand have a similar market or food culture? My impression is not, but obviously it's got a lot of farming, but it doesn't have that kind of same history, or does it?
No, but as I've learned is that New Zealand in the 70s was not necessarily a place that used olive oil, but it's really leapfrogged. And I think both in New Zealand and Australia are countries that, you know, with the big influx of immigrants that have really shaped the culture and the food. So Aucklandness is, you know, has an interesting, eclectic, you know, group of restaurants and chefs and
maybe
a bit more than the Spanish tend to really love the food so much that that's what they do, versus in New Zealand you get a bit of a variety.
The upsides of globalization and immigration. Great. And a couple of others. Do you think artificial intelligence, AI, is going to be overrated, underrated, neutrally rated? Obviously that's quite a big subject, but what do you think of AI?
Yeah. It is. I'll be brief on that one, but I am hoping it is underrated and it will play a critical part in our lives. And obviously technology is so important for the solutions that we support, because we're trying to get them to very remote areas and we're trying to do it cheaply, and it needs to play a part. I mean, mobile money has been in Kenya since 2015, and data is getting cheaper. I mean, you can find 4G in a village in Mali. So you need to really design it for that type of future. Now, there is a ton of grants in the AI space, and you know, all I'm hoping is that it lands in the right hands, because otherwise it'd be such a waste. And we have we have an organization called Digital Green. And there, it was a spin-off of Microsoft India, and it's a really Rikin Gandhi who runs it is a very unique individual that has the technical know-how, but also the understanding of what is the life of a farmer and what needs to happen, right? So he does believe that we still need a bit of fine-tuning, but they have this library of 7,000 videos that they think that if you can get a picture and tell, you know, and say I'm a farmer in Andhra Pradesh and this is June and then understand this is chilies, then you could get some really good advice on you know, the white slice in my chilies. So that's there's a lot of things, but again, in the, you know, AI grant money in the right hands will be fantastic.
Yeah, huge potential. I think I agree. Obviously some risks, but I think I also sit on this side that I think the potential outweighs that, and really hoping that it is continues to be underrated. Great. Okay, and the last one here comes under the heading of billionaire philanthropy. So obviously in the philanthropy space, we kind of think we could do with more funding. One of the critiques, I guess, is that maybe governments should be doing more and that billionaires are not pointing in necessarily the right direction for all of that. So underrated, overrated, or any thoughts on billionaire philanthropy?
Underrated.
Yeah.
There's always need for extensive checks with no strings attached. And this is where this new money is coming in, which is fantastic. So a few have emerged in recent years, like the Audacious Project and the McKinsey Scott. And, you know, our grantees have been the very lucky recipients of a lot of that. So we have seen firsthand on how an organization that is starving, and starving is something that also it's changing in the views of funders, right? But we've heard it many times, like, why do they need my money? Like, you know, why do they, you know, they should be only working on 3 months of run rates. You know, that's not how companies, they don't waste money every 3 months. So you get these big grants and people have 1 or 1 year and a half of run rates. And that means that they can hire that fantastic CFO and invest in the systems. And it's been game changing.
Great. Yeah, I think everyone could probably afford to give more, at least in the rich nations. Like, I definitely think it's been generally a net positive. So I'm in agreement with you there. Great. So wrapping up with the last couple of questions, one would be current projects that you or Jasmine are working on, or any thoughts about current or future projects?
Yeah, we've been, I think I've touched a bit on, in this conversation, but we have been operating for the last 15 years, and we now have a team in place. We're trying to double down on our portfolio, which is exciting, but also packaging our learnings for what we call the doers and the donors, right? The doers are the practitioners, and the donors are the people that write the checks. And what is it that we have done and do and can do that we can help, you know, philanthropists are new, and you know, they can skip a few steps and a lot of it is on, you know, the diligence and the criteria and all these things that we've discussed today. But on the other hand, is how can we help the people outside of our portfolio? So that's been that's what we are internally trying to discuss on what that looks like.
Great. That's almost your own meta ability to scale the information and the work that you do, right, to a larger audience, which might have it. Excellent. And then the last question would be, do you have any life advice? So this would be advice to people who either want to be social entrepreneurs or maybe want to be in philanthropy, or any other observations you have had of being based in investment banking, have experience of Europe, experience of New York, experience of New Zealand. You know, you have a lot of great life experience. Anything you'd like to share with us?
I'd say that spend your 20s working really hard in this very high pressure environment and getting all the skill sets that you need, you know, accounting, communications, analysis. And that's when you should do it, in your 20s, right? So then when you're in your 40s and 50s, you can choose to have those more meaningful roles. We're Jasmine, all of us, wake up in the morning and say how privileged we are to be doing this kind of work and working on these incredibly interesting problems and these promises, because it's so optimistic, knowing that there are a lot of really good people making big changes. But we all have a seat because we've done a ton of work. And I think it's what the social sector needs. You need people that have spent their, good chunk of their 20s and early 30s bringing this commercial skill sets. We now have a team, an eclectic team. One comes from venture capital, the other one corporate finance. We've just added someone that came from strategy. So it's I think that would be my advice. Do that. Come to our sector.
Yeah, that sounds like great advice. I think there's sometimes I meet some young people and I think there is a mistake. They kind of think, oh, we finish university, that's our learning over. But in some ways, in many respects, it's just beginning. And the more skills you pick up earlier, particularly in your 20s, they compound. Like the ability to understand a cash flow or balance sheet never goes away. And then the more that you see them over 10, 20, 30 years, the deeper understanding that you have. So the skills you pick up, definitely really valuable.
Yeah.
Great. So on that, Nina, thank you very much. And please do check out Jasmine for people listening on.
Thanks, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you want to find the transcript or other links, go to thendobetter.com. And please do like and subscribe or leave a review, as it helps others find the podcast. Thank you. Be well.